Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And today we are joined by a very special guest, Reverend Dr. Asa Lee.
Welcome.
How y'all doing?
So, Dean Lee, well, I say Dean Lee because you're my dean, but Dr. Lee currently serves as Associate Dean for Campus Life and Director of African American Church Studies at Wesley Theological Seminary, where I am currently enrolled. So, This is good and intimidating. Dr. Lee oversees the academic and vocational partnerships that serve the students in the program and coordinates the seminary's partnerships with African-American faith communities across the country. He teaches courses in the study of African-American religious experience and practical theology with emphases in preaching, church leadership, and spiritual formation.
Wow.
So,
okay.
The topic for today, well, you see from the show title, it's the education problem. And so, Dr. Lee is here to clear up a couple of things for us.
Oh boy,
yeah,
clearing up.
Yeah, I mean, it's good
we
to have,
appreciate
a, it's clearing good to have up. A okay. professional in the room. All right, so what is the problem? There exists a divide between what's being taught in pulpits of our churches and the lecterns of our academic institutions, specifically our religious institutions. So, yeah, I mean, you can go to your regular. Secular colleges. Is that what they call it? I don't know what they don't call themselves that.
Secular? They just call themselves colleges.
Right. So not those. These are like academic institutions of with a religious focus. So I guess we arrived at this because prior to myself becoming a seminarian, I had always noticed through my travels and playing at churches and sitting in services all over the country that what happens in church is nothing like the scholarship that is going on. And I always wondered, why is there this aversion to, from the church pulpit, what goes on in the scholarship or scholarly circles? And then also the other way. So you see some of the Black church traditions that may not be approved of or taught at the seminary level. And so that's what we're talking about today. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lee.
Glad to be here.
Anything you want to say about yourself that I missed?
Nope.
Okay.
Other than I've experienced as a pastor, not just a scholar, so I've had to work with Black churches and as a pastor and having to pastor them. And I will say that my commitment as a pastor when I started coming out of seminary was I went into debt.
Okay.
You know, student loans and all that. So my first pastor at post-seminary, I said to them, I said, listen, I got all this education. I didn't spend 3 years and the money that I spent to do it. So whatever I got, you're going to get.
Okay.
And that led me down a path of disruption, I would say, a ministry of disruption in a good way.
So now I'm curious. This wasn't part of the outline, but you came out of seminary and went right into pastoralship?
Yeah. So I was already, it's a rarity now. That's not the case. For Black students, it's not a rarity, but I was a student who had served in ministry since I started ministry when I was 16 years old, playing in churches, paid ministry since I was 16 years old. So I had a whole long experience, almost a decade of experience of ministry, similar to what you just discussed about sitting in and hearing one thing, but reading something else. But in my 3 years of seminary, I didn't really do a whole lot of active ministry other than what was required of me in the degree program. But when I graduated, 6 months after I was graduated, I got called to a church in Arlington, Virginia, as the assistant pastor. And I served there for 10 years.
Okay.
And right out of seminary, back into ministry.
That's interesting. I'm going to talk to you about that later because this is a Baptist church, right?
Yes.
And that's not the norm. Like, if it's AME or something like that.
Being appointed is one thing, but being called into an environment is something else.
Okay. That's a different conversation. Not this conversation. All right. So, Black people in America have had a challenge with education in general.
Yes.
We go back to when we were first brought here and some of the punitive measures that came along with attempting to educate yourself or be educated. You would think as a slave trying to read, you may, you know, catch a whip or worse. And so you had slaves who maybe did not want to pursue that education and then others who actually actively fought for education. Mm-hmm. And so they were taught, you know, in secret by people and learned on their own and things like that. Right. So, but you also have starting to develop this ingrained fear of education or the fear of the results of obtaining the education.
So there's some nuances there.
Yes, that's
there's some nuances there. Even before we talk about becoming educated, we're talking about the punitive measures that were aligned with becoming literate. So I think that, you know, beyond a traditional idea of thinking that education only takes place in the classroom, you were actually expected to be educated and skilled in as much as you were needed to be, but you were not to have control over that access to that education or the growth of that education.
That's
so
good.
I think that our initial exposure and experience to formal education, because there was a lot of risk associated with that,
right,
led to it's almost like it becoming like legend within the community, within families, that if you could initially become literate and then become educated, that somehow sets you apart from the greater group. So you do have people, or you do have examples where there was a fear of reflecting whether or not you were literate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have always had a tradition of celebrating those amongst us who were smart, wise,
yes,
learned.
That's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. So we're speaking about a specific type of education.
Mm-hmm.
So even though a slave may or may not have been able to read, they knew how to work that field, or they knew how to care for that house, or
exactly,
they knew how to care
you
for
were
those
expected
children
to be highly skilled in as much as you were needed.
Correct.
So even to an extent, not to speak way beyond my experiences, but even an enslaved person or a free Black person who had a command of scripture was expected to be able to turn that scripture, not unlike what we expect preachers to do today, to inspire, to teach certain principles, to enforce certain rules, to enforce certain norms. But I think the punitive part comes with, did your access to this wisdom, did your access to this new information somehow raise your station beyond someone else's control? So I don't think we were expected to be stupid.
Right.
We were expected
to know
to
your
not
place
be smarter, or
right,
to not exactly
to know
not
your place.
You know,
the
overstep
smartest
our
you could
bounds
ever be was to know your place.
Yep.
And mother wit and intelligence and experience and all those things were primary educators,
mm-hmm,
for us. But you always were the limiter on all of that was knowing your place.
Exactly. Right. No matter how much,
how
you
smart
all,
you were.
Exactly.
Yep.
You, there was another station. You were not ever over anything.
Right.
Okay, good. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, good. You're welcome.
So we move from there. We're jumping in history to what we spoke about at the Board of Education episode,
mm-hmm,
where lack of access to education became the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And through various legislative programs, Black people were prevented from obtaining the education. And we discussed how whole school districts were shut down as
mm-hmm
a response to Brown versus Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
This is from 1954 all the way into the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Even in this neighboring state of Virginia, where Black students had to be educated in like houses and
mm-hmm
warehouses,
yes,
and churches and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And and education just was lacking, or was it did not allow them to participate at a level of children who were being educated full time in a school district.
Right.
Which continues. I mean, this is not the topic that we're on, but which continues in that there's a direct correlation between the integration happening in the South and the rise of Christian schools,
mm-hmm,
in the South. So that white Christian schools, white churches,
segregation
begin
academies
to create parochial schools alongside those schools to really house the white members of the and educate the members of the white,
mm-hmm,
congregation, and not, you know, children from the Black neighborhood around the corner, which then translates to 21st century homeschooling movements,
mm-hmm,
of the same kind of discriminatory efforts.
Mm. We finna get written up. Somebody complain.
I think we're okay.
I
the
love
FCC
it
doesn't check for us, so we straight.
They're gonna be like, you know what?
All right. And then we have to just mention, Carter G. Winston says, the philosophy and ethics resulting from our educational system has resulted in slavery, peonage, segregation, and lynching. So mm-hmm. there is an element to the way in which we have been and are educated that does not work in our favor in many cases. It yeah. has not served us, black people.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Get me right.
All I'm going to say is, while that is true, we talk about formal and informal. There mm-hmm. are things that I think that we've done culturally that protect the passage of information. So even from, if we talk about pre-1865, the strength of oral traditions passed information, critical information, from one generation to another. So it's like, even in my family, we had this tradition of, you know, our male forebear was a pastor. So it was his son, mm-hmm. then his son. Those sons became deacons. The women served in the church, but they were also, it wasn't just for nothing. It becomes almost like the cottage industry of that family. This is what we produce. We're passing that information, and we pass it almost stealthily, regardless of whether or not we have access to these formal classrooms. Once you get in the formal classroom, I think that that's where you have to contend with the outcomes of not having access when you are in your formative years, having to get your education under duress. That's traumatic. I don't think you ever shed that. The books that are produced by our early PhDs, by our early scholars, are almost these guideposts to tell you that it's attainable, but it's going to hurt you. It's going to cost you something. So I don't think that gets wiped away just because even now we might have access to better institutions. Getting a public education in this country for people of color can be a traumatic experience. So that valuation, again, goes along with some of the things we've internalized or just distorted about what it means to have access to this formal education. Or do we value some of the things that we've done culturally that ensure that we are informed into the generations?
Which is exactly why I always struggle with Woodson, Carter G. Woodson. Mm-hmm. I've always struggled with him because what he's talking about is formal education.
Mm-hmm.
What he's talking about are the formal systems and structures when he speaks about the miseducation of a Negro,
mm-hmm.
right? The same phenomenon that you just described that has to do with passing down information because we're oral people. And what we do is we pass on from what we've experienced to you orally, which is not formalized in any way,
mm-hmm.
but has rules and traditions and structures,
mm-hmm.
but not formal in the Western sense. Right.
Because it's not theirs. They didn't design it.
Correct.
And we shouldn't look at, when you center yourself, we've talked about this. When you put yourself in the middle of your own experience, you have to not immediately say that which is not formal or not designed by the majority is not valid.
Right.
Because you didn't have access to it and it wasn't designed for you. So like even when we talk about the movements in the 90s for Afrocentric education, that was so controversial because it was turning the whole model on its head, where people finally said, it's not about the delivery, it's about the design. Design the curriculum for the student, put the student in the middle of their own experience. That is not anything that anybody intended to do, even with Brown.
Yep.
We're saying all this to say, the quick history lesson, that there are reasons, there are challenges that have led us to a point where we view our education differently. Even it's coming out in this conversation, like we have to distinguish between which type of education we're referencing.
Mm-hmm.
And it is important to acknowledge and affirm those non-formal types of education. A lot of this conversation is also about formal education, which is the thing that we have been blocked out of in many points.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so back to the original problem.
Mm-hmm.
Why, and I'm going to ask you, Dr. Lee, why do we believe that the divide exists between the pulpit and the lectern?
Sometimes called the town and the gown. Sometimes called the pew and the lectern,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's this, that those dichotomies tell you that this is not anything new.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it is not uniquely black, right? It exists in Protestantism
mm-hmm.
broadly.
Mm-hmm.
But for black folks, it is part of a sort of a paradoxical mindset where there is an expectation of education, period, of all sort of clergy or even lay folks in working in Black churches. The question is formal and non-formal, mm-hmm. right? But if you go to the hush harbors of the where the Black church is formed and created, it is the non-formal experiences, and I'm going to make a distinction between non-formal and formative,
okay.
right? So non-formal in that it is not a part of the white Western construct, but formative in that it is essential in the growth of the spiritual lives of Black folks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Black slave preacher is educated, quote unquote, by the Spirit,
yep.
by their experiences. And there is valuation between the quote unquote educated preacher who goes to find and can read the scriptures
mm-hmm.
and the one who can interpret the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real line between the two. And so there's a valuation that happens very early on. And you can make there are studies on this. You can talk about the differences between the historical movements of the Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, and all those kinds of things in church history. But what happens is the charism of spirit, which is more akin to what African slaves experienced
mm-hmm.
in spirituality
mm-hmm.
versus Western book learning, for lack of a better term, right? Well, that dichotomy gets personified in the Black churches of the 18th century, even in churches. I think the best example of this is the African Methodist Episcopal Church,
yep.
right? Where you have two branches of the church. You have a spirit-filled church that Richard Allen sort of mm-hmm. carries forward. And then you have a Daniel Payne church where all of the trappings of Africanism,
mm-hmm.
right? Spirituals and spirituality, overt spirituality, are frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
So what you get is a liturgy that's high, a worship that is scripted, and an evaluation on the fact that, you know, we're read.
Yep.
And we can read. So we're gonna sing hymns.
Okay.
So the AME church and since its inception has had this thing going where you might go to a certain AME church in the Washington, D.C. area and get shouting and running down the aisles and seemingly no order,
mm-hmm.
quote unquote. But then you might go to another AME church just down the road that has mm-hmm. high order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. So it's a part of the Black American religious experience very early on that there's this distinction between the two. And there are churches and denominations that get born out of that experience.
Okay, so that's a good representation of, like, I'm evaluating you. Thank you for that representation of the Black church. Now, I want to talk about in our academic institutions,
mm-hmm.
the reverse or the converse of what you just described is a devaluation of some of those spiritual traditions that are, in many cases, learned or innate in African spirituality that have made their ways into the churches, i.e. The ring shout mm-hmm. from West Africa that mm-hmm. makes its way into a shout, the call and response and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
How have they been viewed in academic institutions? Like, are they taught? Are they acknowledged, affirmed? What's the role of those as we're learning?
So I think it's as myriad as the expressions of Black spirituality. I don't think so in most white theological academies and seminaries, what you get is sort of a what is called contextualization, which is what I would describe more as a devaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this is the spirituality of a certain group of peoples, and it doesn't have any context for understanding.
Hmm.
I think there are people very early on, beginning in the 19th century onward, even folks like one of the prominent figures in the Pan-African movement who is not studied, Edward Bligh,
mm-hmm.
who was a precursor by almost a generation or more to Marcus Garvey,
mm-hmm.
who talks about spirituality. He's an educated Presbyterian minister.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he's several different denominations, but he ends up immigrating to Liberia, West Africa. And he talks about the native practices and the native spirituality of native Liberians and the tribes there. And he filters them through his own Christian faith. Now, he, in his own day, he's not well received.
Right.
But ironically, in the 1970s, long after his death, here in the United States, African Americans and Africans begin to revisit Blyden to really explore what he's really talking about. And to say he's onto something. And that's, Blyden talks about a lot of things, education, economic empowerment, all sorts of things. But spirituality is one of the topics he discusses, because what he says is there is an innate spirituality that we all have. And so how do we process that? So to get the long way around to your, to the answer to your question, is that there's always this suspicion of the devaluation of African spirituality that's in our churches and in our religious practices. And so Cone, James Cone, is not, you know, is able to voice it in a way that others may have been on the margins. But James Cone is the first person in the heart of the academy who articulates a robust approach to Black spirituality that most academicians in his day don't agree with.
So I was reading this book called The World That Created New Orleans. I think I've mentioned this book on the show previously. I love this book. But the long and the short of it is, I think that a lot of traditions that fall outside of this white Western construct for churches not only has been devalued, but it's been othered. Like, it is not a pure reflection of either a relationship or a strong community connection or something to be venerated or celebrated when you see these manifestations of what you know is an African-rooted, if not African-centered, celebration of one's spirituality.
Right.
So, you know, what we, the wailing, the speaking in tongues, the dancing, the catching the spirit, these these were things that were present in our pre-1865 communities. And I think it's best to say that because we say slavery, but no, it wasn't just amongst people who were fighting to express themselves at all. That fight it went over and across your status as a slave or a free person. There was always a fight to be authentic to oneself. The trick of supremacy is to make you believe that your most authentic self is the one that aligns most to that top reflection of humanity that you are constantly seeing. But when you put yourself in the middle, like, I don't think that's a coincidence that in the 70s, as Black people were moving themselves into the center of their American experience, they were looking for voices and looking for information and looking for resources.
Looking back.
Exactly. And they were saying, we've been doing this. Has anybody talked about this? You know, if you're if you are, and I could only imagine, even in the study of history, at one point in time when I was looking at majors, I would see that at PWIs, at predominantly white institutions, not only was history offered, but maybe there might be a minor in African American history, or there might be a whole major in African American history. To choose an HBCU and then to study American history through the lens of Black Americans, that's a gift because the information is presented already with people like me in the center. So instead of these expressions being othered, these expressions are. And they just are. And sometimes the biggest affirmation you can receive is that you are, as opposed to you are in comparison to this other thing. So just for that, you know, just offering that, things are going to change when you put yourself in the center of your spiritual experience. We've talked about this even in terms of being Black and female and being in worship or being, you know, a part of ministry or being a part of a church. When I put myself in the center of my experience, everything changes. When I put those people like me in the center of that experience, things change, perspectives change, or my understanding goes deeper. I could only imagine how that might have been writ large for a community that was thriving on the margins, but also being told you have to participate in this majority structure for validation.
Which to use your language, that's what Cone does when he posits a Black theology, right? He puts Black people in the heart, in the center of the formal academic reflection on God in theology, which brings with it all of us.
Right.
All of the experiences, right? Positive Academy. Doesn't mean that the Academy wasn't thinking about it. It means that it was being devalued when it was thought about. And so now to say that God is black is to fundamentally make what was devalued at the heart of valuation. And that means we can no longer vilify, right? So then over time, what gets implicated, in that is really Cone's critiquers and critics come along and all sort of say, it's not just black men, it's black women. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then later on, it's black gay men, it's black gay women, it's black, you know, it's all of these, right?
So it is all the many facets. As of we black make life. Space for one, you make, end up making to, space to for make, somebody
else. To say
else.
Something is black is to bring with us all the myriad of faces
all of
and all the complexities of life with us. But it's taken almost 40 years for that to really flush out in the implication. And it's still being flushed out in that way. So the long way around is to say that it's a process of devaluation that now has been affirmed. And I think academies are still struggling to figure out what it means.
Of course.
Right. So the academy has a role in that, but I think the front line of bridging that gap are the pastors and the ministers in the pulpits that may not have interacted or engaged with that scholarship and the scholars who do that. So Cone bridges the gap between King, one of his influencers, who devalued that black experience in terms of the expression, the church. And then on the other side, you have Malcolm, who affirms a lot of the black experience or that black identity. Mm-hmm. And Cone, he stands in between those and says both of these are valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So how do you see churches bridging that gap, whether it's through the way Cone did it or other strategies?
Well, I'm going to push a little bit about the characterization of Cone.
Okay.
Not your particular characterization, but specifically, Cone was not well received as a churchman.
Right.
Right. So what he's saying did not resonate with churches.
Right. No, I'm not saying.
Right.
I'm not
right.
Saying
you're talking about black life and mm-hmm. black national identity.
Right. So in his theology, he brought these things together.
Correct. So in that regard, he is a bridge. But in another regard, he is not. Right. So Cone is not well received because what is existing in most black churches at the time of his writing is a white theological construct that he's challenging. So I say that to say there are two bridge builders that are possible to make this work. One is the scholar church person, the persons who have one foot firmly in the church and one foot firmly in the academy. So yours truly would be one of those individuals.
Okay.
But there are lots of others in a lot of different academies. Dr. Shively Smith, who was on our faculty, is now at Boston University, who has a strong commitment, is ordained African Methodist Episcopal, but she is the first black woman to graduate from Emory University with a PhD in New Testament, which, by the way, only happened a few years ago.
Mm.
So she has a foot firmly in the academy and a foot firmly, right? So there's scholars all across the world who have commitments to the life of the church, who are working to translate the academy to the church and say there is a standard, right? And here's the thing. When we say there's a standard, it doesn't always mean formal academic education, right? It is to say there has to be some training, right? Whether that is all of your deacons need to go through a class.
Yep.
The pastor can teach it, but read a book. It has to be a class, right? Or if you're going to be a ministry leader, you got to be such and such and so forth, right? So, you know, to say that there's a standard, but then also to help the church to understand the value of education, you need pastors who are willing to venture to the academy, right? The pastor's job is not necessarily to have a foot in the academy. That's great if they do, but to venture to the academy for their own training and for ways and resources to train their people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back up. You and I know what the academy is. Explain that too.
So when we say the academy, what we're talking about are the formal structures of higher learning, right? So classes, degrees, certificates that are recognized not just in the church, but across regions and mm-hmm. globally, right? So a right. master's, just like a doctor of dental science,
if
is
you look
a
at it like industry, it's an industry level right. credential,
right? It's a credentialing or professionalization, mm-hmm. right? It's a ministry as professionalization, and so there are degrees that go with that. There are trainings and there are objective certifications that go along with that. Mm-hmm. So when we say the academy, it's that whole ministry industrial complex, you might say, that is a certification in and of itself.
Okay, so in my time at Wesley, which has been great, I've heard many times the fear as people send their young persons, potential clergy, to seminary, that they, you know, the warning to not lose your religion, or mm-hmm. they're gonna mess with your Jesus, or mm-hmm. they're gonna do this. Is that something that as faculty, like, you worry about, or is that something that you know is just gonna happen? They just got to deal with it.
It's just gonna happen.
I think I'll speak for myself. I live for messing with people's Jesus. I mean, I did that as a pastor. I did that. I deliberately found holes in people's theology so I could take it apart and pull the thread until the sweater came undone. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the, because that's how you learn what you don't know and what's sacred to you, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to start pushing against sort of your notions about right and wrong, or your notions about what Jesus said, or my particular favorite, what the Word of God is, right? If I'm going to push, if you really stand on that, then let's figure out what you really mean. And do you really, are you really about that life that you're going to say,
yes.
you know, this is what it is. And so you're going to send your friend to hell because the Word of God say, yeah. right? Those kind of things are really important. And in seminary, our job is to establish a baseline and to help you not to be parrots, but to figure out what it is you do believe and how to use the skills to be able to articulate for yourself what mm-hmm. it is you do believe. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know that. So it's not a worry. It's not a worry of us as faculty members that, you know, you're going to be shaken. We expect you. The heart of education is disruption.
It's to shake you up.
That's the heart of education. The other heart of education is repetition, but that's a whole nother conversation.
I'm going to tell you one of the things that impressed me. I don't know if this is normal or not, but in the orientation, actually, you were speaking at the orientation. One of the first things that was said was, you know, that is going to be an issue where you're going to be challenged and stretched, and some things that you have held as sacred will be torn down.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, here are some counseling services for you. And mm-hmm. which I think is amazing, because in a graduate level academic institution, if I'm getting the MA in math or something like that,
right,
they don't need counseling, because whatever is presented to me or whatever I'm learning is not shaking or even touching my core beliefs, which also addresses my identity and who I believe I am.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
But in this environment, because you're doing it, the fact that I don't know if that's come as a result of some hard lessons.
Absolutely. It has.
But that's critical for what a seminarian is supposed to do. So to worry about losing your religion or messing with your Jesus, yeah, that'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
And here's how the institution comes alongside you and says, okay, yeah, you're going to be okay. And so I think that's valuable and very considerate of.
I think the irony is that the person getting an MA in math actually does need a counselor too.
They do.
But for very different reasons, yep. right? I think the counseling situation for seminaries and theological schools goes to the heart of identity, right? Faith, because faith goes to the heart of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we start poking at faith, then we are really messing with the core of your being, which you've articulated. But then the struggle is that all of us have issues that face us. You don't have to be in seminary, right? Mm-hmm. If your mother dies, if something tragic happens to you, if you have a car accident, if you lose your job, those are all faith crises if you're a person of faith.
Mm-hmm.
So then how do you process this if you're not allowed to ask questions in church, right?
Right.
If God doesn't make mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. These things that we say that are faith mm-hmm. things that we don't really, you know,
subject to scrutiny.
Great way to say it, right? Mm-hmm. That we don't really pick apart and poke.
Right.
Seminary is a place where it's a safe place, and that's why counseling is there, but it's a safe place to do that, because if anybody should be able to help you to process that, it should be your pastor.
Mm-hmm.
But your pastor needs to go through the challenges of it, of themselves, before they can go to the next level.
So there's a program, once upon a time I was interested in pursuing a PhD in pastoral counseling. Mm. And at the information session, they said
that... I'm gonna bug you about that now.
That's fine. At the information session, I'll never forget that the one of the professors said, the wounded healer must heal themselves. And there's no way that you are going to be able to counsel someone else if you have not yet been through counseling. And that a lot of students present in this, you know, in this particular program because they have a rescuer type of syndrome.
My goodness.
And they want to be a part of rescuing you while drowning themselves.
Mm.
So to even get in the program, you had to get 10 hours of counseling or therapy. And I was petrified because I was like, what? So, but it lined me up directly with confronting the fact that I didn't even know. I was one of those younger students, one of those people when I was an undergrad, Black people don't experience depression. Mm. You got to work harder or you're just having a bad day.
Mm.
I was in the throes of it, had experienced those life-changing issues, had lost my dad in my undergrad years. And shut myself off, all of these things. When I went to this orientation session, what she said sat with me because I said, wow, if I really want to be of use to someone else, if I want to help, I cannot be afraid of receiving that assistance.
Right.
So dare I say, anybody who studies anything remotely related to the social sciences, that, like you said, that math student needs counseling because they might be confronting needs support because they might, in their pursuit of that degree, confront imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. depression, isolation, being overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And just because they're studying something finite does not mean that they will not evolve as a human and say, or experience these things in their humanity that just say, I'm not good enough, or I'm not working hard enough. When I was studying history, when you say, you know, somebody's going to mess with your Jesus, it was my freshman year history professor.
Yeah.
Who said some things matter of factly and then looked at me and said, it is your choice to love him. And I said, oh, what? Because that is not how anybody had ever presented my religious experience or my faith experience back to me. Now, I had heard one time from the pulpit that I needed to know and establish a relationship for myself because it would not be enough to pull off of what my parents had. You know, you can't thrive on your mama's relationship with God. So when I mixed all these things together, I realized that whatever was going to be deconstructed, I was going to have to actively participate in putting back together. And it needs to be something that no longer felt foreign or forced or inauthentic to me.
Mm.
So a lot of things came apart and came away that I think need to, because when you are refining something, the process of learning refines you in putting yourself through the rigor of the structure of it. So when somebody says, I really don't know what you're dealing with, but that paper's due on Friday, you know what I mean? Or you got to do these readings, or you have to do your speaking, or whatever it is. These things are meant to refine you, and you realize I'm undergoing this training, but I'm also developing as a person.
Mm-hmm.
You make it all fit, you know, somewhere. The gift is when it all fits down the line.
Wesley does some innovative things with specifically targeting Black churches in the area. You want to talk a little bit about those?
Yeah. So 6 years ago, I put together a package of programs and initiatives that now Wesley calls the African American Church Studies Program.
Ooh.
The program is sort of an investment of Wesley, a historically white Methodist institution, in the life of an African American institution, the Black Church. And in the Washington, D.C. area specifically, there is some of the most wealthiest, largest African-American churches in the whole country. So some of these initiatives have to do with lay education, mm-hmm. being able to teach people how to be better at the calling that they feel God has laid on their heart. So whether that's being a good deacon, superintendent, trustee, etc. We have a conference coming up that's dealing with the ministry of church finances, because we are tired of, I am tired of fish dinners and the caricature and of the black fund. Church of the build. Yeah, the building fund, the fish dinners to fund the building fund, okay. those kind of things. Right. So in an age in which white congregations have mastered ways of planned giving, mm-hmm. estate management, mm-hmm. endowments. Some of our largest churches in the country still operate on year-to-year budgets, mm-hmm. right? Really? Year-to-year budgets where you have to pay for a roof out of your building fund,
yeah.
right? There's something called capitalization that you should be working on, right? So mm-hmm. set some money aside, right? And at the same time, our institutions are preaching sort of we need money, we need money. We're also trying to get our parishioners out of debt.
Yeah.
Right. So how's that work? How's that, you know, so equipping folks to do that, equipping churches to do that. The degree programs themselves are about getting in African-American church studies about thinking, getting clerical leaders to think imaginatively about ministry. So, you know, we've got courses on hip hop in the city and doing theology in urban environments. Mm-hmm. This spring, we have a course on Toni Morrison, a course that predates Toni Morrison's passing. Mm-hmm. It's been a course in the curriculum for a number of years, but looking at the question of theodicy, what does it mean when bad things happen to good people and mm-hmm. bad things happen in life? What is Toni Morrison's view of that? I'm teaching a course on Spike Lee, the Black theology and social critique of Spike Lee, and all of those are meant to get black church leaders to be imaginative and creative and to see differently in our African-American communities and not just delineate everything about what simply the Bible says in black and white. So mm-hmm. that's kind of some what we're doing at Wesley around black church studies.
Every time the course schedule comes out, I'm like, how many of these can I take? I mean, they're not even like my core requirements. I'm like, that's how I ended up in Beyonce and the Hebrew Bible, because it just happened to be J-term, and I was like, I could do this.
You can fit this in. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, so thank you for spending some time with us. Before we get out of here, do you feel, understanding the conversation that we've had about informal, informative education, mm-hmm. do you feel that it is a valuable endeavor for clergy and or lay people to attend seminary?
Attend seminary to be educated. I think seminary is not for everybody.
Okay.
It is valuable for those who feel called to it, right? I know the students. I've been in theological education for 15 years, and I've been in education longer, the field of education longer. Mm-hmm. I know now, from the first time I meet somebody, I can tell whether they're called to the work of education, theological education. Mm-hmm. They have a sense of clear understanding about what they've done in the past in ministry and what they offer. They may not know what to do with it. They may not know how to do it, but there's a thirst for learning that is willing to be poked, mm-hmm. willing to be challenged, willing to go to the next level, willing to say, you know what? I've been hurt that way before too, and I want to figure out why, right? Though that's already innate in them. For some, they can't handle it. The level of rigor, the level of study, all of it is too much to handle, and the environment is not beneficial for them. It doesn't mean, however, that they shouldn't be educated. It just means that seminary mm-hmm. and the way the pedagogy that's at work, the formal pedagogy, the way in which they learn and way in which you're taught, right? As my former education professor would tell me, there's a difference between teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. And so pedagogy is really the philosophy of teaching and the hope for of your learning. There are people who cannot survive the pedagogy. Mm. They can learn, but the structure and the way in which seminary operates is not for them. Wesley has alternative programming for them, right? We have something called Course of Study, which is not designed to be as rigorous. It's as deep, but not as rigorous And the pedagogy is really to be more practitioner oriented. So everything you do is about reflection. You're already pastoring, so reflect on your pastoring, right? Reflect theologically, reflect biblically, et cetera, et cetera. For others, it might be that their own pastors are the place of education. But that again goes back to the clerical leader. I do think that anyone that is charged with the spiritual leadership of a community needs to be trained, because a dentist is licensed and trained. Mm-hmm. A medical doctor is licensed mm-hmm. and trained. I mean, morticians have to get a license.
Yeah.
Right? So if you know, this notion that somehow if you're pastoring somebody, you don't need any education. Again, I'm making a distinction between education and seminary. Mm-hmm. That you don't need any training at all is very problematic, and does not, in an age in which everybody's educated in some way or form, and the hypocrisy of Black folks telling children to go get an education, but somehow the pastor doesn't have one, that's a real problem. So yes, I think everybody should get some sort of education, and for some, seminary is the education that they get.
Thank you for setting us straight. I do not want to die, and I want to send a shout out to Jazz Hands over at the Brown Liquor Report because she actually introduced us.
That's correct.
So
Jazz went to high school. We went to high school together.
Yeah,
she's my childhood best friend.
Yeah, everyone in here knows Jazz, so we can't not mention her because
hey, Jazz.
I don't want my text to be on fire.
So anyway, thank y'all for hanging out this week. Thank you very much, Dr. Lee.
Glad to be here.
Yes, thank you for joining
Thank
us.
You.
For Faith Uncut, I'm Yo's Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.